I am going to try to hold your feet to the fire, folks, as you deal with this petition. Please try really hard. The court is really bad, so we need your help to move it along and so that everybody that's come can speak and can be heard by the court and the court's questions can be answered. And so hopefully we can also get to the next matter, which is one that was started by the Bar Association a number of weeks ago. So to begin, Mr. Caccini, if you would go ahead, that would be terrific.
Thank you, Your Honor. My name is Michael Caccini, a co-petitioner in this petition. My other petitioner, Attorney Terry Rose, is unable to attend and he sends his regrets. I have limited, given the short time frame, I've limited myself to 3 points that I would like to make today, and I think I can move very quickly. My first point is that since filing this petition, I've given a lot of thought to it, and I see a lot of wisdom in what Attorney Robert Hennick has filed. We have a subtle difference. He essentially agrees with the changes but thinks that those changes should be made to clarify the rule and that the State Bar and the OLR's position is actually incorrect. And the reason I tend to agree with him on that is that since I filed my petition, I've talked to a number of lawyers, people I would consider both smart people and good lawyers, ranging from solo practitioners like myself to partners at large law firms such as the one where I used to work. And what I found is that no one I have met is aware of this rule. This rule, of course, bans the attorney speech of even public information about closed cases after the fact. And this rule is violating unknowingly every day. Now, I don't use that as a justification to say that because a rule is violated, it should be changed. It is quite possible that a very small number of people are correct about the rule. For example, a small number of people being perhaps represented by the State Bar and OLR. It's possible they could be right and the rest of the legal community is wrong. But that is not the case here. And the reason is that the rule, and this is why I said I tend to have been swayed by Attorney Hennick's filing, the rule doesn't say what the State Bar and the OLR want it to say or claims that it says.
What's the number of the rule again, and then tell us what it exactly says?
It's 1504, we called, and that's what he's speaking to us now.
The rule prohibits an attorney's use or revealing of any information related to a case. And the key point, I think, attorney.
What rule is that?
Ethics Rule 1.9. Supreme Court Rule 1.9. Also, it's contained in Supreme Court Rule 1.6. 1.6 relates to current clients. 1.9 relates to former clients. I should state that our petition, what it is not, it does not deal with any, we're not asking for any change with regard to current clients who have pending cases. Our rule is primarily concerned, at least from my perspective, with political speech, not commercial speech. Certainly, what we're asking, the reason the rule should be changed is that I'm not just talking about anti-client speech, but pro-client speech. And as I've indicated, the rule, as the State Bar and the OLR interpret it, prohibits an attorney from discussing widely available public information that's been published on websites, such as a Supreme Court decision, and it prevents an attorney from talking about that, provided that it is in some way connected to the attorney's earlier representation. And I'll give an example how this came up, and I think this will put it into context. I initially intended to write a law review article centering around an appellate case. I was not involved in that appellate case, but I had been involved in the case at an earlier level of the proceedings. And Rule 1.9 prevents me from, as interpreted by the State Bar and OLR, would prevent me from discussing that, even though it's public information, because it is related to the representation of my client. Now, is this rule followed? No. I could have done it. I probably could have gotten away with it. It would probably go undetected, as it does almost all the time. But that's not a good reason to leave the rule on the books. What it does is it chills speech, and it certainly chilled my speech. I did not write that law review article. I instead wrote the law review article that gave rise then to this petition. But its chilling speech is one problem, and the other problem for most lawyers out there, because it's interpreted, you could argue either it's written irrationally, or as Attorney Hennick argues, it's just being interpreted irrationally by the State Bar and by OLR. Because of that, it runs a very high risk of arbitrary application to attorneys. So that's why it's important to change this rule, even though it is true that it's violated daily and it's true that it's rarely serves as a basis for a disciplinary matter. In fact, I think of the submissions that were written in opposition, I think there was only one case cited where it had actually been used. So again, the Supreme Court has said that when you're in this, what this rule serves as is a perpetual ban on an attorney's speech of public information. That's what it's doing. And the Supreme Court has said in Gentile versus State Bar of Nevada and in many other cases that when a state regulation implicates the First Amendment rights, it can impose only narrow and necessary limitation on lawyer speech. I'm sorry, Your Honor.
I'm sorry for interrupting you, but I wanted to get a question in.
Yeah, absolutely.
What about, I think the ABA model rule addresses informed consent. How does your proposal differ from the ABA model rule? I'm speaking with regard to 1.9. How does it differ, and why have you made it different?
Yeah, and here's the problem with getting informed consent. I don't think it works. If it were that easy to do it, this might not even, I might not even be here today. But here's a few problems with informed consent. Number one, there's really something that sits wrong with me about me having to ask a client's permission and consent to talk about public information. And for me, in what I do, I like to write law review articles. For me, what this is, it's a published appellate court case. So to me, I don't think I should have to get client permission to exercise a basic First Amendment right about a published Supreme Court case or appellate court case or whatever the case may be. Two, I've actually worked with Attorney Rose. We've tried to draft up something that would satisfy informed consent. The problem with informed consent is it requires a weighing of the benefits and risks, and it has to be in writing, and it has to be with consultation with the clients. Anytime you go, for a lot of the clients I deal with, individual clients, not necessarily well-educated, I do 100% criminal defense work. If I ask the client to sign something that was so complicated that it actually would comply with this informed consent doctrine, clients are going to be distrustful of that because no client would expect his attorney to remain silent about the public published aspects of his cases. Secondly, the lawyer-client relationship, especially in criminal cases, can often be contentious. And this is an area that doesn't affect me, but there's a widespread problem with corporate clients actually actively prohibiting law professors from publishing articles. Because what happened is these law professors, typically these days they stop at a big law firm for a year or two, then they go into academia. Well, the problem is, even though they may have never met the client or worked on that client's case, per se, their firm did. And when they want to come out and write a law review article, for example, in environmental law isn't strong enough, well, this corporate clients, they've gotten wind of this, and they're actively suppressing the speech of these law professors. Because they're saying, well, we're a former client. That's information relating to the representation, even though you don't have any true secrets about us. This rule is much broader than true secrets. That's the problem.
What's the basis of their lawsuit? In the back of my mind, I think there might be a provision that says that these rules cannot be used as a basis for litigation, civil litigation.
Right. What they're doing is they're threatening ethics complaints, from what I'm aware of. Now, mm-hmm. I haven't studied that area extensively. I should note I have published an article on this, which is now in print. It wasn't at the time that I filed this petition. It is with the Vermont Law Review. It's on their website. It's in print. It's in the most recent edition. And I do mention that in passing. That's not something that I spent a great deal of time with because it doesn't affect me as a criminal defense lawyer. My political speech is always pro-client, pro-individual rights. So I'm not in that position where I would want to take a position opposite of a former corporate client. But that is an issue. That's a problem for the attorney.
There is a series now on Netflix that deals with the Stephen Avery matter.
Correct.
Now, I've only watched a couple of those episodes, but the district attorney, a former district attorney, is commenting on the case as well as others.
Correct.
But I want to focus on the former district attorney.
That is, I suppose the state is right. his client.
Right.
How does this rule as currently written and interpreted, I guess, as currently
yes.
interpreted, affect someone who represents the state? And is there a problem that you hope to cure with your new revised suggestion?
Right, and I think, and I've seen this not only with regard to that case, but in other high-profile cases where prosecutors have gone on the news and talked about it, nothing in the rule gives an exception to prosecutors just because their client is a government body rather than an individual. So to be consistent, I think the State Bar and the OLR would have to concede that unless they somehow got informed consent, and I know in a lot of cases that's not happening. I don't know in that particular Avery case whether it happened or not. But that would be a rules violation.
From whom would you anticipate an assistant district attorney or your district attorney to get informed
right. yeah.
consent from?
I don't know in that case, and that's why I think, even though I'm a defense lawyer, but I think the prosecutors should have equal free speech rights in this regard. They're currently exercising them, mostly because they're not aware of this rule, at least the ones I've talked to. Or they just know that it's very unlikely they're going to be reported. But I don't think they should have to worry about that. I think prosecutors should have the free speech rights as well, talking about public information that was aired in a public forum, such as a courtroom that's open to the public, or in a published appellate court decision. I think this rule would benefit them as well, and it would clear them, and they can exercise their free speech rights as well. I'm not only one-sided on this. I certainly want ideas to be out there, and I think they should be allowed to do the same. But I agree with you that, or maybe you didn't state a claim, but I would agree if that is your position that prosecutors are barred from doing that under this rule. They're just not aware of it. And I would think at some point perhaps a district attorney's office might file a complaint against a prosecutor if they're not happy with what he's saying or what he's doing. In the prosecutor's case from Making a Murder documentary, he's now a defense lawyer. Should his office be upset by the things he's saying or the publicity he's bringing, there could be a complaint filed. So I think that's a real risk as well. That's one that I don't think should be a risk. I think that prosecutor should have the First Amendment right to discuss what happened in that courtroom. So that's my position, and that's what this rule would do for that prosecutor as well for defense lawyers who want to talk about public information. I think, not in the order I had planned, but I think certainly I've covered everything I wanted to say. And, Your Honor, I thank you for your questions. I would just say at this point the rule is so broad that bars speech about everything, including published appellate court cases, that cannot be considered, even if the OLR, the State Bar, can cite to one case or five cases where it did prevent something. It is so broad, it's perpetual, never-ending ban on free speech that it cannot be justified. It's way too broad. It's not narrowly tailored. And therefore, I think the rule is inappropriate. And the fact that it's not enforced often, I don't think should be a reason to leave it on the books. So we ask that, on behalf of Terry Rose and I, we request that the court grant our petition. Thank you all for your
Finally,
time.
Finally, would you walk me through, you cite a couple of cases from other jurisdictions that have knocked down these similar provisions.
Yes.
Walk me through that.
Sure. There's one. One comes to mind, and I don't know if it's one I've included. If it's not, so much the better. It'll give the court some even greater insight. There's currently a debate in California regarding Rule 1.6. Now, that's slightly different because it deals with current clients, but it's the same language. It says you cannot reveal information. And there's an ethics opinion, and I've put it in my article. It's cited in my article. What happened is at a sentencing hearing, the question in the ethics opinion is, what should the defense lawyer do when the judge asks, does your client have a criminal record? And they're all up in arms about this. They don't know what to do because there's candor toward the tribunal is one ethics obligation. And then there's the obligation not to reveal information about your client. So what they've come down on is they've said, well, given these two conflicting rules, what the defense attorney has to do is say, judge, you have to go get that information yourself. Now, that's where this really is a problem, because the whole purpose of the rule is to protect the client. Now, if I tell a busy trial court judge who asks me if my client has a record and I know he's got a conviction and it's on CCAP, my job is to alert the court to that, minimize it, and explain to the court why it shouldn't be relevant for the sentencing hearing and why my client's changed at that point in time, things like that. The worst thing I can do for my client is tell the judge, judge, go get it yourself. I'm not telling you about it. So what this rule does is it's so broad, there's conflicting problems with other ethics rules, other statutes, and it takes all discretion away from attorneys. That literally has removed our ability to make judgments about what to do, what to say on behalf of a client. If I walk out after a case in a trial that I won, and a news reporter says to me, can you comment? And would the client rather I say no comment and walk away, or would he want me to say we're very happy, my client was innocent, justice prevailed today, we were able to demonstrate to the jury that the state didn't prove its case and we're very pleased with the outcome. This rule doesn't take the client's true wishes or protection of the client into account. That's just words we're hearing, but when you analyze it and look at it, this it doesn't accomplish that. So we think it's in everyone's, certainly the client's interest, certainly lawyers' free speech rights, for this rule to be changed.
Thank you.
When I read your petition, I read it to only define generally known information. That's the only underlined new stuff. Is that right?
We are asking for generally known to include publicly available, which I think is very fair in today's electronic age. Everything is available with a few keystrokes. And then we're asking for the word reveal, basically for the court to say that information that is generally known has already been revealed. And this is where Attorney Hennick's argument, and he'll be speaking, and this is, I think, where what he says is very valuable. He's saying you can't reveal what is already in a published Court of Appeals decision or on CCAP. It's already revealed. So that's what we're asking for, a change, so that information that is generally known is deemed to be already revealed and we can discuss it. And we're asking that generally known information include publicly available information and things like that. Now, that's already being done in many states.
Well, Counselor, doesn't subsection C2 already talk about reveal information? So your argument in some respects makes your changes to sub 2 redundant, because you say, well, you can't reveal information that it's already that's already known, and sub 2 talks about reveal information. I mean, that's already in the rule.
Right, and I see what you're saying. And if the problem is that the OLR, and that's my real concern here, I don't want to test this when I'm being disciplined for something. I want to clear it up now. Their position is, the OLR's position is, you can reveal public information. That if I go to a CLE seminar and I present on an appellate case that I handle, for example, I'm revealing information. That's the OLR's position. That's the state bar's position. So that's why I put that in there. It seems redundant. And I think it all comes down to this. Do you want to start with the proposition that the state bar and the OLR are wrong and they're just interpreting it wrong? Or do you want to go with the proposition that, well, they're right, but we need to change the rule? So that's the difference between Attorney Hennick's position and mine. I don't think it matters substantively. I'm starting to see the wisdom of his position, as I said, because I don't think you can reveal a Supreme Court case that was published. I think that's impossible. So that is that's our position.
Okay.
We recently, I'm sorry, I should let you finish the answer to my first question.
I'm sorry, could you repeat that?
Yes, because I said what you are doing is only defining what's generally known to be publicly available or already disclosed in a public forum.
Correct.
And I suppose those are fighting words, what's publicly available or disclosed. And I assume in sub 2, the generally known is defined in the same way as you define it in sub 1. Is that right?
Correct.
Well, I was surprised there's such heat on this and such long discussion, frankly.
The generally known is described, for example, the restatement on this topic, the restatement of law governing lawyers. It's something I cite in my article. They discuss this, and they have a good working definition of generally known. I don't think it's or what is publicly available. They say, if I recall, anything that is available for free in a public database or available at little cost and little effort. I think by what we've done here, could it eliminate every possible argument? Well, no, but it's much better than what's there right now. Because right now, as I said, right now it's so broad it bans public speech about you know, appellate court cases. So that this is, I think, a huge improvement. It does not define public, it does not define what is publicly available. That is certainly in other sources. And I'll give you an example. In Minnesota, for example, there was a case where an attorney impeached a former client at trial with his prior convictions. The attorney represented him on those prior convictions. It was the rule about, have you ever been convicted of a crime? If so, how many times? And that was the end of the inquiry. And they said, that's not a violation. That information is generally known. So Minnesota has addressed this. The restatement addresses this. The Supreme Court of Virginia has said that the rule, they had a rule that was much narrower than Wisconsin's, and they said it was unconstitutional. I do cite in the brief supporting the petition several states that have parted from our state bar's view on this.
We had a matter up recently, and unfortunately I haven't quite gotten it clear in my mind what the matter was, but the court discussed the word disclose, and I'm hoping one of my colleagues will remember this, and they said, Justice Prosser may be signaling that he has some recollection, but can you disclose something that's already open and public? And I think the court answered no, but I can't remember in what context this came up.
I was thinking of the same thing. Justice Bradley asked a question. Mr. Pierce gave an answer. And I can't for the life of me remember what it was.
Where? In the other matter that we're talking about?
I think that's what... Do you remember that?
Yes, we were discussing in a different rule, as I recall, the last time we were here.
Could you speak up? Yours not coming through the box, nor is it Nancy. Go ahead.
Please. I'm not coming through the box, Chief.
I'm talking to you.
Okay. I think we were discussing a rule about the situation if an attorney would refer, my hypothetical to him was, if an attorney would call another attorney across town and say, I'm referring to you this real estate case, and he's got a good family, he's got a couple of properties, blah, blah, blah. And that was considered giving information about the client. And you were, if I may say, I'll tone it down, you were surprised at that. Yes. Mm-hmm. That's where the disclose came up.
And the rule, and Your Honors, the word here is reveal. And what some authorities have tried to do is substitute in for that word, such as... what's the word I've heard before? Disclose or convey rather than reveal. So a lot of authorities, I can't speak for our state bar on this, but a lot of times in some of the cases I've read in my research for the article, they will literally try and substitute in a word that doesn't belong there to try and justify such a broad reading. Because certainly I could communicate to you public information about a published, let's say, appellate court case that maybe you're not aware of. I could communicate that public information to you, but I can't reveal it to you because revealing is to make something secret or hidden generally known. That's the definition of revealing. So I think one of the things we have to be on guard for is the disciplinary authorities trying to substitute a word in for that word reveal. And I think that's a problem and has been in some states. I'll suggest this. I'm a better writer than I am a speaker. If any of Your Honors would be willing to spend another half hour to an hour reading things about this. I spend a great deal of time on the article. It's well organized. It's well researched. It includes a broad range
of
cases.
Even if you have to say so yourself.
That's true. I can't guarantee it's going to be entertaining reading, but I can guarantee it's well researched.
You can send it to me.
And it is. There are so many cases across the country where these rules are conflicting and lawyers are getting disciplined for complying with one rule but not the other. So that's one of the things I address in the article. And I only raise that because it's far better organized than my presentation here today.
Well, you're doing fine. I gather that Mr. Hennick thinks you're not changing the rule, but that any clarification would be helpful.
I believe that's his position. He intends to speak, but I think that's exactly what he'll say.
All right.
Anybody else have a question? Thank you very much.
Thank you, Your Honor.
You will send me the article then?
I will.
You can send it to every member. Council?
Every member.
Send it to everyone.
Why doesn't he just send it to Julie?
Yeah, it'll.
Yeah, you could just send it to Julie.
Have memorized the site.
Yeah.
I have the site. I can buy it.
Yeah.
I can do that. Mm-hmm.
Either way. Okay, Mr. Hennick, I'll take the podium, please.
Thank you, Your Honor. He's taller than I am. Okay, can you hear me now?
I can hear you.
Just
fine.
Speak well into the microphone.
Yes, thank you. Yes, Mr. Cecchini is correct. My position is that the proposed amendments are not changing the rule. They are, in fact, clarifying the rule. And what I would like to focus on in my limited time, understandably limited time, is three things. One is what the current rule actually says and why I say we're not trying to change it. Two, what the new rule, there is one exception. The new rule proposed might be a change, and how to address that. And third is how to address the problems that OLR and the State Bar seem to foresee in the proposed amendments and how those can actually be, I think, pretty easily corrected, or at least have the defendants' or clients' rights protected. First, the current rule, which is 20:1.9 sub C, there are two provisions. The first one, sub 1, addresses the situation in which the attorney wants to use evidence that is detrimental or potentially detrimental to the client. And the language there is, the attorney shall not thereafter use information relating to the representation to the disadvantage of the former client, except as these rules would permit or require, that's 1.6, with respect to a client, or when the information has become generally known. So we already have the provision, even when the information is to the disadvantage of the client, that it can be used when it is generally known. The question is what generally known actually means. That's a subjective standard. Lawyers going into it don't, if you have 5 out of 10 people on the street who know it, is that generally known? But if 4 out of 10 know it, it's not generally known. How do we, going into something which is, after all, a First Amendment protected interest, how do we know going into it whether a particular statement is going to be a violation of the rule or not? The second provision applies to information that is not deemed harmful to the client. And under that, the rule says that the lawyer shall not thereafter reveal information relating to the representation, except that these rules would permit or require with respect to a client. So subsection 1 deals with detrimental information and covers both revealing private information and use of public information, something that's already been revealed in some way. The second deals with non-damaging information and only applies when the attorney reveals that information, makes it public. So my reading of the rule, and I think we always have to go back to the actual rule rather than just stating our assumptions about what they say, is that the first rule, even when the information is harmful, it can be used by the lawyer under certain circumstances where that information is public. The second rule, dealing with information that is not harmful to the client, that can be used whenever you do not disclose private information. So public information, the fact that I represented Joe Smith on an appeal 3 years ago, the result was this, these are my briefs, they're all publicly filed, those kind of things, you're not revealing anything because those are publicly available, they're readily available. However, if I am trying to use that to harm a prior client, then that's a different standard. It has to be generally available, whatever that means. Now, what I would suggest as a way of dealing with this, you can have different standards for the different situations. The State Bar, OLR, they are most concerned, and understandably so, with a situation in which a lawyer is trying to harm a prior client. This is the Harmon case. Harmon. It's the Harmon case, where the attorney tried to use medical records, giving that to a prosecutor to try to undermine the credibility of a former client. Now, in that case, the medical records were not currently available. They were filed in a prior civil action, but that case had been dismissed, and the file was destroyed. So this is what I would suggest, is that in that first circumstance, that sub one, that what the court provide is that generally known, that would be defined to include publicly available. However, the second provision, the reveal, if it has been revealed before, under those circumstances, what the lawyer is allowed to provide, since you're not trying to hurt the client, if it's been previously revealed and it's or it's publicly available, there's no reason to prevent the lawyer from stating that information. There's no reason to prevent a lawyer who is specialized in criminal defense work or criminal appeals from using the fact that in a publicly filed case at some point, a particular argument was made in a public document. You know, that is not being disloyal to the client. The client is not expecting that things that are publicly filed are going to be private. The client is expecting, number one, that private things stay private, and two, that the lawyer isn't going to try to hurt me.
You're talking about sub C.
Yes.
That's where the information is used, quote.
Yes, C1 is information is used.
C1, yeah, and C2...
is revealed.
Right.
And the difference between those two is used includes both revealing and putting to use information that already is public. Reveals, however, is limited by its definition to things that are not already public. So the question is how, when we're dealing with a First Amendment issue that requires certainty rather than vagueness, how do we define these things in an objective way so that a lawyer in my circumstance can know whether or not if I teach a CLE course or if I write a brief and cite to a case and discuss a case that I represented a client on before, I'm violating the rule. And I suggest that the way to do that, again, is for the generally known, that is defined as including what is publicly available.
Why does, you think that this just doesn't change the language?
No, it clarifies.
It clarifies it.
Yes.
But OLR and has taken a, looks like to me, a strong view that it's just awful.
Yeah.
So why?
Why have they taken that view?
Tell me, in your words, why they think it's awful.
I do not know because they have not explained that. I have gone to a number of seminars with Mr. Pierce, who I think has done his best to explain their position, and that lawyers need to be, you know, very careful of this because this is their position. But I have never heard an actual explanation based on the language of the rule that would justify saying that Mr. Cicchini can, you know, cite my cases and discuss my cases in a CLE program, but I can't. Because, you know, of the 100-plus published cases, the 300 or 400-plus cases that I've handled where things are filed publicly, for some reason, I can't discuss those.
Well, Mr. Saleen's comments, which are short and to the point, which is under tab 9 in our book, says the disclosure in Harmon would be permissible if we adopted this petition.
That is correct if we adopt the whole petition. That's why I was suggesting the change that I did. The change that I did and the solution that I did. Now, under Harmon, the attorney, again, was trying to harm the client, okay? And at the time, sub C2 did not exist. The only thing that existed was the what is now C1, and that's the use of information.
Right, not the reveal.
That has become generally known.
Okay.
Okay.
Okay, you can do it if it's been generally known. You cannot do it if it has not been generally known. In that case, the only the issue in that case, I think that the attorney was arguing that, well, it was disclosed in a public case. Well, that's fine, but the public case has been destroyed. It's not available to anybody now. It's only available because you are telling people about it. So you are, in fact, revealing this now. You are, in fact, it's not generally available. It's not publicly available. So what my proposal was is that for that provision, for where you are hurting the other or hurting your former client, that the generally available be limited to the basic idea of general availability, which would include where it is available now. If it is not available now by going online or by going to the courthouse or by going to the newspaper or whatever, then it's not generally available. So in Harmon's case, it would not fall within my provision. Excuse me. Or usually have water when I'm up here arguing. But so under my proposal, it deals with that. Harmon remains good law under my proposal. But at the same time, attorneys and their clients are both protected because the use of the information, first of all, you can't use private information at all. And public information you can only use if it is actually publicly available. It's in the public realm.
Okay. Thank you very much. Are there any more questions for
what exact change would you make to the Terry Rose et al. Provision?
Okay. Unfortunately, I have a copy of the proposal from the Legislative
proposal
Review Committee.
Proposal says in one, generally
yep, here
known.
It is.
Pardon me?
Okay.
And are you on your own
my own
comments?
Language.
What yeah. page?
Well, it's not. I'm looking at the very first page of the memorandum that Mr. Cicchini filed. And he has generally known information includes information that is publicly available. I would stop right there.
You wouldn't say or has been disclosed in a public forum.
Exactly.
That's what you would take out.
Exactly.
Does it change the meaning of that?
It changes the meaning of that because disclosed in a public forum would cover the issue in Harmon.
Mm-hmm.
And it would and the people who were opposed to this proposal, this petition, were basically focusing on issues of when the attorney can use information that is harmful to the defendant. So that's the one change I would make. I would take out information that is generally known.
But if it's been disclosed in a public forum, it's publicly available.
No.
Now, what it would be is instead of the language that is there right now for sub one, I would change that to generally known information includes information that is publicly available.
Period. But I'm
and take
saying
out the other part.
If it's already been disclosed in a public forum, why isn't it publicly available?
Because it is. I am specifically referring to the Harmon case, where it was at one time publicly disclosed. However, that file then was sealed. So it is no longer publicly available. You can't go to the courthouse, pull the file, and look at that document, look at that transcript, or whatever the document was that was filed.
So it's a time thing. Generally known information includes information that is publicly available now.
Yes. Yes, at the time the comment is made. Because if it's not publicly available now, then you're disclosing something, you're revealing something.
Anything
so don't
else?
You need to say that?
Anything else that you would change?
The one other thing I would take out the addition in sub 2 that he has proposed information that is generally known has already been revealed, and I would suggest putting in the comments that basically the definition of generally known that was in subsection 1. So you can't reveal something that is either publicly available or has previously been disclosed in a public forum.
Hold, I'm getting a little mixed up.
Okay, I'm sorry. Okay, yeah, it's the two different aspects of this. Mm-hmm. If it's not going to hurt the client, then you don't have to worry about whether it's available right now. If it's already been disclosed at some point, then you're not, you know, really revealing something new. Somebody knew it at some point. So it's no longer, you know, confidential. But, you know, the fact is that if you just go with the publicly available, I would be fine with that. I'm just trying to, you know, make this as simple as possible.
Just for clarification then, with regard to sub 2, the reveal information, vis-a-vis the proposed change, you would get rid of any proposed change. You would be not including what the petitioner had requested. Information that is generally known has already been revealed. You would delete that entire sentence.
Well, I would ask that either it be kept in there or that information be shifted to the comments.
Well, you can't have very easily generally known being defined in two different ways, one right above the
exactly. And generally known is not, yeah, I agree. Generally known should not be defined again in the second provision, in the sub-provision. There should be something, see if I can come up with some quick language here. Information that is publicly available or has been disclosed in a public forum has already been revealed.
Thank you very much.
Where would you put that? Go ahead.
Replace the change to sub 2. Instead of saying information that is generally known has already been revealed, I would put in there information that is publicly available or has been disclosed in a public forum has already been revealed.
Thank
and I think that
much.
Would handle the
well,
issues that
you
the State
have
Bar
to
has.
Do that in order to get back to the beginning of sub 2, because sub 2 does not refer to generally
right.
generally
right.
known. Okay.
Right. It,
got
it. It addresses revealed.
Okay.
Thank you. May I? One question.
Oh, sure.
two questions.
Okay.
Do I understand that the proponent of this rule agrees with you, or is there a difference? What is your understanding?
I believe that Mr. Cicchini is interested in getting the substance of the change, and I don't believe that he is wedded to the specific language. He will, you know, okay. I'm sure that he will jump up and down if he thinks that,
well,
that I'm mistaken.
Well, he'll get a chance to come back at the end. And
okay. In C1, generally known information includes.
Yes.
That implies to me that there's something more that that is publicly available.
Yes, and that would be correct. And what that does is we are providing an objective standard, the publicly available objective standard. If there is a subjective something beyond that, I can't imagine right now what it would be, but unfortunately, I just can't think what else it would be.
It implies to me there's something more.
There could be, yes.
So,
but this sets the minimum standard, the minimum standard that publicly available information is. You're not going to be, you know, brought up on charges if the information is publicly available. The idea of generally known. I don't know what source or that would be. I personally would have no problem with saying, with just changing it so generally known information is information that is publicly available. It, you know, if that accomplishes the goal, I think that would be a tremendous help. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Ellen Hennick.
Thank you very much for this opportunity. I'm going to speak just very, very briefly, not about the substance of the rule, not about the language of the rule, but about one of the key reasons why I think it's important to clarify. Initially, when this came up, Rob was obviously very involved in it, and I thought this was a big kerfluffle over nothing. That was my initial reaction. And then I saw what was coming back from the State Bar and from OLR, and I became concerned. Why? Because their position, which I don't completely understand, because like Rob, I read the rule the same way Rob does, would mean that we are inadvertently setting a group of new attorneys out on their own. And I know that sounds like a big leap, but because I do a lot of teaching, I take a lot of phone calls in which the question is, what does a brief look like? Unfortunately, we have a lot of new attorneys, and that's a valid question. What does this motion look like? Well, motions are easier. I have some templates. How do you make that argument? And my typical answer has been, oh, I made that argument in a case. Go look it up. And the reason I have them go look it up is for two reasons. One, to learn how to look it up. And number two, to see it and see it in writing. Because I can talk as long as you want on the phone. And number one, it eats up my time. And number two, it's not the way people learn. If the rule is interpreted the way that OLR and the State Bar are suggesting, I could refer perhaps to one of Rob's cases if I knew about it from before I joined his law firm. But I couldn't do it with one of my own briefs, and it doesn't make any sense. And there is a huge crop of new attorneys who no longer come up the way probably most of us did, under somebody's tutelage. And they are out there. And if I can't refer them to briefs or to motions that have been publicly filed, and nobody else can either, I honestly don't know what's going to happen, because I get a huge number of those kinds of calls. And that's really all I have to say.
What in the rule, or what in the State Bar thinks that that's their interpretation, that you cannot say to some fledgling new lawyer, go take a look at my brief that I filed where I made that argument? What makes you think they would say?
Because as I'm understanding their position, what's not generally known perhaps is whether I represented that client. I'm not quite sure. I just know that what they're suggesting goes as far, for example, as I can't say that's my case. I know that the interpretation has been that, now we do this because we do get consent from clients, you can't say on a website, I represented this client. We get permission to do it. It is on our website. You'll see it. But that's with consent from the client. I suppose we could change our fee agreement letter, but it's really kind of awkward to figure out how you exactly would phrase that. Probably could. It just seems, but I obviously couldn't go back to all of my public defender clients and do that at this point. I had enough trouble finding them when I was representing them, let alone 10 years later for many of them, except perhaps those who were in for homicide, where I probably do know where they are. But, I mean, that seems to be the practical problem. As far as how they get there from the language, I don't understand it, and you're really going to have to ask them.
Thank you very much. Mr. Pierce?
Thank you for the opportunity to address the court. I come today on behalf of the State Bar's Standing Committee on Professional Ethics to express our opposition to the suggested changes. We agree with the Office of Lawyer Regulation. Unfortunately, Mr. Dietrich, who's current chair of the Standing Committee, could not be here today. He's in Washington, D.C., but he, I believe, sent in a letter, too, expressing his opposition to the suggested changes. The current rule on confidentiality, and really what this boils down to, is we're talking about Rule 1.6, And in the fiduciary relationship between lawyer and client, and the client being the person to whom the lawyer owes duties of loyalty and confidentiality under the rules, under common law, even under some circumstances under contract, who controls that information? When the model code was superseded by the rules of professional conduct, the drafters of the rule, the ABA, made the conscious choice to change the coverage of the confidentiality rule from confidences, meaning information protected by the lawyer-client privilege, and secrets, meaning information that would be embarrassing or detrimental to the client if disclosed, to all information relating to the representation of the client, whatever its source, as we see in paragraph 3 of the ABA comment to Rule 1.6. So the conscious decision was made to expand the confidentiality of information. The reason for that was the previous code had put the decision-making in the hands of the lawyer about what would be embarrassing for the client if revealed, what the client would consider to be detrimental to their interests. And the ABA, the drafters of the rule, viewed it as the case being the client's case, the lawyer having fiduciary responsibilities of loyalty and confidentiality to the client, the decision should be in the hands of the client.
How can you disagree with concepts of loyalty and confidentiality? They're at the heart of the what it means to be a lawyer in the legal profession.
I agree.
And Dean Dietrich wrote a letter and essentially said that. It was brief and highlighted those things. But here you have arguably some speech involvement. The petitioner talks about free speech. But, you know, there are certain things that seem over the edge. There are certain things that seem that we are setting up people for violations. Take what I just gave as an example earlier, referring to a prior hearing. The example, and I'll modify it now, just because I can't remember the particulars, but let's say my cousin comes into my law office and asks me to do real estate work, and I don't do it. So I call someone in another firm and say, this is my cousin, Bill Smith. Good guy. He's been doing a lot of real estate deals in the last 10 years. Most have gone well. That's a violation. That's not name, rank, and serial number. And when you were here last time, you said, essentially, more than name, rank, and serial number, and a call from me to an attorney I'm referring to is a violation. But it happens, you acknowledge, across this state every day.
Well, the point I was making in the prior hearing, Justice Bradley, was that client identity or identity of a prospective client is information that relates to the representation of that client.
No, but that makes no sense to me that I can't call a lawyer in a firm that deals with real estate and say what I just said.
Well, what the confidentiality rules as currently drafted are intended to dictate to the lawyer to do is simply to ask the client, would you like me to contact another attorney who may or may not be willing to represent you on this matter? I'm more than happy to make the introduction, but rather than the lawyer being, I don't need to even ask the client. That is to say, if the identity of prospective clients was not protected by confidentiality, if a man comes in to see me and I'm a family law lawyer, says I'm considering divorce and I have no obligation to protect his identity, the fact that he consulted, That would mean the lawyer would be free to say, boy, I'm going to call the wife. Let her know.
Let me follow up with something the petitioner is asserting, particularly in this case. They're saying when attorneys, and particular criminal defense attorneys, are prevented from talking about public aspects of their cases, the public suffers to a great extent. Yet Rule 1.9 prohibits an attorney from discussing, writing about, and otherwise disclosing even public information, including what happened in his or her cases in open and public court. What's wrong with that?
Sure. Let me preface that by saying I think there's some confusion between the terms or concepts, rather, of information that's generally known, information that may be publicly available, and information that may have been disclosed in a public forum at some point. So if you accept what is generally agreed upon to be the definitions of those sorts of information, published appellate decisions would, everyone would agree, would be generally known information. And mind you, the prohibition in Rule 1.9 is on adverse use of information unless the information has become generally known. Neither in Rule 1.8, which governs use of information relating to current clients, nor 1.9 is there a prohibition on use of information that is not adverse to the interests of current clients. So I
What's the sub two? Shall not thereafter reveal. Now, I suppose you're saying is revealing using, but you know, close enough. I mean, that's different, of course, but it is prohibiting. You're saying it's not prohibitive. It is prohibited with respect to revealing information relating to the representation, except as these rules would permit or require with respect to a client. So it's prohibiting that.
That is correct. The duty of confidentiality, like the lawyer-client privilege, survives the end of the relationship, even survives the death of the client. But again, the conscious policy decision was made to say, back in the early 80s, we're expanding the duty of confidentiality. And I think at this point it's important to emphasize that I think some of the ills that petitioners suggest are caused by the rule simply don't exist. There is no conflict between the duty of confidentiality and any of a lawyer's duties under any rule. They don't exist. It doesn't conflict with obligations under 8.3, 4.1, whichever rule you would choose. They're consonant in that aspect. Secondly, with respect to publicly available information, it clearly is protected under Rule 1.6, right? It says all information relating to the representation, irrespective of its source, right? But for many of the uses, for example, lawyers' use of information about their clients in marketing, the comments to Rule 7.2 acknowledge that representative clients with their consent can be listed on a lawyer's website. But it seems to me that if the genuine concern is, all right, we're talking about published decisions, we're talking about information that is easily and readily accessible to the public at large or widely disseminated, granted, that is a shortcoming of the current rules. It doesn't define the concept of generally known. But to adopt the language that petitioners suggest, wherein information that is disclosed in a public forum is no longer protected, we expressed our concerns In our filing, the Office of Lawyer Regulation and the Harmon case stands as an example. Once those records had been filed in a public court, the lawyer, who owes an ongoing duty of loyalty and confidentiality to the former client, is free to use that information to embarrass, to assist the opponent of the former client.
What about Mr. Hennick's modification? Is that acceptable to you?
I'm afraid I had some difficulty in following exactly what he was suggesting.
I'll read it as I understand it.
Please do.
Under 1, C1, generally known information includes information that is publicly available.
Is information.
Public includes information that is publicly available, and it's at the present time and when the information is being disclosed.
I would have to give that some thought. I don't believe, and we haven't discussed it in detail, so I cannot speak on behalf of the committee at this moment, that any member of the committee would object to a clarification in the comment to Rule 1.9 as to what exactly generally known information
Is your committee meeting on an ongoing basis?
We meet 5 or 6 times a year.
Okay. And if you brought this suggested change by Mr. Hennick to the committee, could you provide the court with a written statement about what the committee's conclusions are as you've provided statements before?
Yes, we certainly could do that.
Thank you.
There was some discussion about how the proposed rule would benefit a prosecutor. What is your comment?
Well, I don't believe necessarily that the current rules hinder a prosecutor to a great extent. It's an open question, since it's not defined under Wisconsin law, who exactly is the client of a government lawyer. And I am unaware of any prosecutor in Wisconsin history of being disciplined for a violation of Rule 1.6. I generally take the view when I'm giving advice to lawyers that since the government lawyer is representing an organizational client, not an individual, someone has speaking authority on behalf of the organizational client. So, for example, when I represent a corporation, I would look to those who have legal authority to make decisions on behalf of the corporation to tell me what to do as the corporation's lawyer. Similarly, I believe in most circumstances, the elected district attorney, to the extent that decisions of the client need to be made, fulfills that role. So to the extent that the district attorney is making disclosures, he is speaking on behalf of the client, be it the public interest, that aspect of the state of Wisconsin that prosecutes crimes, the Department of Justice, or some would assert that the government lawyer has no client, in which case it would render it moot. You owe no duty of confidentiality to no client. I don't view the current rule as impairing prosecutors' ability to speak.
Thank you very much.
Counsel, I gave you the revised version of one. I'm going to now give you what I understand to be the proposed revised version of number two, which is, if the information is publicly available or has been disclosed in a public forum, that information is not being revealed. It defines reveal to mean that which is not publicly available or disclosed.
As I understand what you just read to me, I would disagree with that.
Pardon me?
As I understand what you just read to me, I would disagree with that. I would be opposed, and I can only speak on my own behalf now, not on behalf of the committee, Because
we're defining reveal now.
Right.
Reveal is to state information that's not publicly available or not disclosed in a public forum.
First, I would offer that it arguably was the intent of the drafters of the ABA model rule that reveal was meant to cover all information relating to the representation. So a lawyer can't voluntarily give that unless you're operating under one of the exceptions. It was not their intent that information in the public record is already to be considered to be revealed. States that did not want to go along with that formulation kept the old model code confidences and secrets formulation of their confidentiality rule. And there are a fair number of them. Most states have gone with the current version of Rule 1.6, but many states stuck with the old confidences and secrets. I think for information that simply was disclosed in a public forum, there, again, we bring up the example of the Harmon case. That, or let me give you another example, information that may have been talked about in a public court hearing where perhaps either minimal notes were kept of it or perhaps no record whatsoever. But if that information was talked about in a public setting, I think it's not protective of the interests of clients to say a lawyer is then free to do whatever they see fit with that information after the end of the representation. The lawyer-client relationship is premised on loyalty and confidentiality. And if I, as a lawyer, tell a client, I might have serious obligations as long as I represent you, but if we go to court on this, when the case is over, your story is hilarious. I know it's embarrassing to you, but I'm free to do whatever I want with it as long as it's spoken about in a public setting. Seems to me antithetical to the fiduciary nature of the lawyer-client relationship.
Thank you very much. I'd like to now hear from Mr. Caccini to respond again.
Just one final question. So the Hennecks, talking about doing a teaching at seminars of talking about their cases, or perhaps doing a digestive update of cases, and those are included that they're handling, or getting a call from a new attorney saying, how do I make this argument, and referring to a prior brief. Is it your opinion they're violative of the code as it now exists?
To the extent that a lawyer would say, oh, you have a question, you should take a look at this case. I see no problem with that whatsoever.
But they have to stop right there.
Well, here's what gives me some pause. I think if a lawyer intends to publish an article or perhaps give a presentation with respect to a matter in which they actually represented the client, my experience of being in perhaps many more CLE presentations than I would wish to be in was that the lawyer who was involved in the case sometimes may tell the audience, I know what the decision says, but let me tell you what was really happening with that case. Let me give you the backstory. I personally am not troubled, although 1.9C is not altogether clear about whether use, simple reference to the published decision, I don't think that's a violation. I admit the language is not clear because of the lack of clarity about generally known information. I do think if we accept the premise that information about the matter belongs to the client, if I want to be able to give some history of the backstory, this is what really happened, the client is deserving of being consulted about this. And some clients don't care. Some clients do care quite a bit. I get reported to surprising clients, large corporate clients, have reported to me they're very upset when their law firms list them on their website as representative clients. Is it a multinational corporation That said, we take that extremely seriously. If we see our name on an AmLaw 100 law firm's website as a representative client, we call them and express our displeasure about this. So clients do take the information that relates to the representation seriously. And I would say this as a final point. I don't think getting informed consent is as an arduous process as it's laid out to be. First, neither Rule 1.6 or 1.9 requires that it be in writing, so oral consent is sufficient. I understand why some lawyers might deem getting it in writing as a best practice, but it is simply not required by the rule. And if I were to say, I simply want to discuss the public aspects of your case, what occurred in court, I thought I got a good result for you. I hope you don't mind. I would discuss these factors and this factors, but I wouldn't get into that. That accomplished through a phone call or a written letter and a phone call back from the client suffices. And I've talked to numerous lawyers through that process who report to me that it's not an altogether arduous process. It's a question of, does the client, does the person whose case it was actually about, should they have a say in the use of that information?
Thank you very much. Attorney,
thank you.
If you want to respond to some of the comments.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm.
If I heard correctly, I think if there's the opinion that a prosecutor has no client and therefore can talk about a published appellate court case, but I could not. How does that protect my client if the focus of these rules is protection of a client? That cannot be right. And if that is correct, then we've got a more serious problem than I came here to address. One of the justices, and I don't remember who, kind of shrugged the shoulders and said, yeah, is it using or revealing? I don't know. That actually makes a big difference whether you're using, if I present at a continuing legal education seminar, am I revealing the information or am I using it for the purpose of educating other lawyers? That's a big problem because the rules as they are written are different. So there's another very vague aspect of this, which simply, as Attorney Hennick said, cannot stand with a basic fundamental constitutional right. You can't have such vague rules. Conflicts between the rules do exist. I discussed one that's a hot topic in California. The state bar responded, did claim that there was not a conflict, but then quickly gave an example of how we can resolve a conflict. We lawyers, we're not all Quarles and Brady's type firms. We don't have committees that can sit around and weigh these things and address these conflicts. The fact that it's conceivably possible to work out a conflict and reduce the risk of being charged is just not a sufficient justification. We also live in a different world today than we did in 1980. Today we have CCAP, we have mugshots.com, we have WISPAR, which publishes all of our cases. We have transcripts of cases that are posted on the web. So in 1980, when this change was made, and I've not been able to find out why the change was made from confidences and secrets to all information, whatever its source, including information acquired before and after the representation, which is in the notes. I don't know why that change was made. I've never heard a justification for it. The state takes the position that, well, here's one case, Harmon, and here's another example. A lawyer might see someone at a bar and run up to him and say in front of his friends, hey, remember that case I represented you on and I won? That's another theme of this. We can't have, the Constitution doesn't allow a perpetual ban on all speech for political purposes to protect against one scenario that could possibly be imagined. That is not constitutionally acceptable. It's way too broad for what it's intended to do. With regard to Mr. Hennick's proposed change, my understanding, and I can answer a question, there were some things, well, if it's about generally known, and why does it say generally known information includes information that is publicly available? And the reason is, again, these rules kind of predate the modern era. So you can go back in the 60s, 70s, and generally known back then meant, well, Mr. Jones is generally known as a solid citizen in the community. So it's more like small community knowledge is what that refers to. So that's why I worded the rule, generally known information includes information that is publicly available.
Counsel, about a minute ago, you used a for political purposes.
Right.
What do you mean?
Well, political as to commercial speech. I don't care for lawyer advertising myself personally. My goal in all this was political speech, writing a law review article, criticizing or praising, as it were, different court decisions. So it's purely political, as in the law should be this way. We should have more rights under the Fourth Amendment, things like that, not in commercial speech. So that's my distinction between the two. And my chief concern and why I'm here is because my political speech has been chilled. There are things I have not said, done, and written because of the rule. So that's my distinction.
Could I just briefly ask you, we have 1504, which is this petition.
Correct.
And 1503, which is a broader petition for amendments of rules of professional conduct for attorneys, where other rules that have been referenced today, like 1.6, are going to be considered and evaluated, not in a vacuum, but as a whole. As I'm listening to you and listening to the people who speak today, I'm wondering why this petition should not be considered as part of that petition. Why shouldn't they be combined and considered? Because it strikes me that while you all are making valid points, they relate to many rules. And if language does need to be changed, it may need to be consistent within the whole spectrum of the chapter. So it almost seems like if this were a court hearing and I were considering, mm-hmm. you know, various motions, I might consolidate them for purposes right. of a decision.
I'm sorry.
Do you have any thoughts in that regard or objections to that?
I don't know much about that other petition. I'm very sorry, so it's hard to speak on. I can say from my perspective, I even ignored Rule 1.6 because I wanted to do something that was manageable and workable here, because with Rule 1.6, you could make the case that even anything I could say could impact a public ongoing proceeding. So I didn't even want to get into that. Might Rule 1.6 be a constitutional First Amendment violation? It might be, but I decided to go very narrow in my approach, so that's why I certainly didn't make any effort to integrate it with anything else going on, and I apologize, I'm not well-versed or even really well aware of those other petitions.
It's probably on the website, so take a look and see what you think.
Okay, I will. And then the final, I think my final point here is it is my final point. My understanding of Mr. Hennick's change is he would do it as follows. Generally known information includes information that is publicly available, period. And then part two, he would make the change as something along these lines, information that is publicly available or has been disclosed in a public forum has already been revealed. If I got that correct, that's the gist of what he would propose, and I would certainly be fine with that. I think I've covered everything I need to, and thank you for the second opportunity to speak, and unless there are other questions, I think that'll wrap it up for me.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you all for taking the time to appear. I know that you're busy, and this is an extra thing on your days that sometimes get very long as it is. So I thank you very much for all of your appearances.
Does someone else want to appear? That young woman in the back stood up before the last speaker. Nope. Okay.
Okay, we're going to move to the final public hearing today, which is petition 1503. And Mr. Pierce, it looks like you're up to bat again. Is there anybody else that has an interest in speaking on 1503 that has not signed up with our marshal? Okay. Yes. Well, I've had a bunch of different you did sign up. I just have too many lists up here. Absolutely. Absolutely. I have you on the list that I was not looking on. Mr. Pierce, do you want to begin for us, please? Now, we had a very long hearing on other aspects of this rule earlier on, and I know the court is well-versed on the concerns that are being raised by the State Bar. So I would ask you to focus on new things today so that we don't repeat what was already done at the prior hearing.
Absolutely. Oops, excuse me. Absolutely. Again, I thank the court for this opportunity. Today, the focus of the hearing is on our suggested rules changes that were not part of the ABA's Ethics 2020 process. And the first one is our suggested change to Rule 20:1.6, sub C. We just plowed that ground, but we are suggesting an exception to the duty of confidentiality, which in our view does cover the identity of one's current and former clients, that would allow lawyers to disclose information to detect and resolve conflicts. In the ABA version of this exception, it is limited to circumstances in which a lawyer changes employment, meaning I'm taking a job at a new firm, so the firm has an obligation to check for the conflicts I might be bringing into the firm, or when a firm changes composition, meaning the merger or acquisition by one firm of another firm. The State Bar's committee felt that the risks to clients in broadening the exception to any situation were minimal. It probably reflected what was occurring to a large extent anyway. And with the cautionary language in the rule, meaning that like any exception to the duty of confidentiality, you only make disclosures to the extent reasonably necessary to accomplish the goal under the exception, and the disclosures would be limited to prevent disclosure of information that might compromise privilege or otherwise prejudice a client. For example, when the identity of the client, him or herself, would be particularly sensitive. Again, I bring up the example to illustrate of the person simply considering divorce. So what, in essence, we're asking the court to do is adopt something closely modeled on the ABA exception, but broader in scope, simply saying, lawyer, under most circumstances, with caution, you're free to disclose limited information to detect and resolve conflicts. So our petition includes suggested Wisconsin committee comment explaining how the Wisconsin version differs from the ABA version to hopefully provide some clarity and guidance for Wisconsin lawyers. Our second suggested change that is not part of the ABA rule is a slight addition to the comment to Rule 1.8, which is one of the things that over my years of advising lawyers has bugged me a little bit, in that we have a Wisconsin unique rule, 7.3 sub E as in egg, which is based on the old State v. Galbankian case, which prohibits lawyers from drafting instruments or documents that require the future services of the lawyer if it's at the lawyer's own suggestion. That rule does not exist in the ABA model rules. Hence, the ABA comment to Rule 1.8 suggests that lawyers do exactly what is prohibited by Wisconsin Rule 20:7.3 sub E. And simply for the sake of providing clarity and guidance to Wisconsin lawyers, we're suggesting a brief Wisconsin committee comment flagging the difference. The reason being, years ago I attended a CLE given by somebody else who was pointing to the language in the ABA committee comment and suggesting to their audience members that they should do exactly that. So we hope to avoid that. Our third suggested change that is not in the ABA comments has to do with Rule 20:4.4. Currently, the ABA model rule has subsection B to 4.4, which imposes one duty and one duty only upon lawyers who receive the inadvertently sent document, meaning the missent email, the missent letter, the missent fax. And that is prompt notification of the sender. The rules of professional conduct impose no duty beyond that whatsoever on the lawyer. Over the years of counseling lawyers, we found concern, consternation, coming from lawyers who receive seemingly privileged missent documents and seeking some guidance. There was an older ABA ethics opinion that essentially adopted the position that a lawyer who receives something that on its face seems privileged and was clearly inadvertently sent to them should stop, notify the sender, and abide by the sender's instructions unless and until a court of competent jurisdiction made a determination as to whether or not that information, through inadvertent disclosure, had lost its privileged status. And given the recent amendments to the civil procedure rules and the growing consensus in federal discovery law that, for the most part, inadvertent disclosure does not waive privilege, provided the lawyer has acted reasonably, notwithstanding the mistake, we felt that going back to the old consensus of if you receive mistakenly sent documents that on their face are protected by an applicable privilege, we included work product in that, that the disciplinary rules should mirror modern evidentiary law. And thus, if it is seemingly protected by privilege, same set of instructions. Stop, notify sender. If you want to make the argument that it's lost its privilege status, that's fine. That's the proper role of a judge in deciding. But in the absence of that, you should be obliged to respect the privilege status of that information. So our rule, as we mentioned, is similar to deviations from the ABA model rules in other states' disciplinary rules. To a large part, we looked to Tennessee's Rule 4.4. for guidance in adopting that. We simply felt it provided better guidance to Wisconsin lawyers and comported with modern evidentiary law. The next change has to do with minor amendments to clear up some confusion about the language in Wisconsin Rule 20:5.7. which has to do with lawyers who organize their firms as limited liability entities. The first is a suggestion in sub A sub 1 that the word licensed be replaced by authorized, proceeding to practice law. The reason for that is it's now recognized in Rule 5.5, which is multi-jurisdictional practice of law, that lawyers who practice exclusively federal law are under federal jurisdiction, and the current version of ABA Model Rule 5.5D, which again was amended pursuant to the Ethics 2020, and as previously discussed, we're suggesting the court or asking the court to adopt those amendments to sub D, would allow certain lawyers to establish a systematic and continuous presence, meaning an office in the state, even if they are not licensed in the state. And this is primarily immigration lawyers who practice exclusively federal law and do not have state aspects. So, for example, most states who have adopted the modern version of ABA Model Rule 5.5 recognize that immigration lawyers need to be licensed somewhere, but as long as they're properly admitted before the immigration agencies and immigration courts, they can establish offices in a state in which they're not licensed. I've run into this on a couple occasions where an immigration lawyer who practices exclusively immigration law wanted to join a firm in Wisconsin that was organized as an LLC. And while under current version of ABA and Wisconsin Rule 5.5, that lawyer would be able to practice, would be authorized to practice in Wisconsin under the current version of 5.7A, because they're not admitted, they could not practice in a limited liability structure, which seems to me an incongruent result. If you're going to say a person can engage in the authorized private practice of law in immigration, they should be allowed to do that in a limited liability law firm. So we suggest that one change to A1. The second is a suggested change to sub D, which again has been a source of confusion. That's the subsection of the rule that allows firms that are organized as limited liability entities in other jurisdictions to register under the rule, open an office in Wisconsin, provided that they have at least one lawyer who's licensed in Wisconsin and who has an ownership interest in the firm. And what has proven confusing to lawyers is sub D references sub B, which is the signing of the registration statement, saying it must be signed by a lawyer licensed in the state and who has an ownership interest in the firm. But I've gotten many calls from out-of-state firms looking to open permissibly and lawfully an office in Wisconsin, and for whatever reason, they can't seem to understand that by referencing sub B, they have to have a Wisconsin lawyer who has an ownership interest in the firm as well. And we don't believe that either one of these alters the substance of the rule, but simply provides clarity as to what the rule means and makes it more user-friendly. Our last suggested change that is, well, I take that back. This one is part of the model rules, but was not part of the Ethics 2020 process.
Which one?
Our suggested new Wisconsin rule, 20:5.8, governing the provision of law-related services, which has been part of the ABA model rules for more than 20 years. And for whatever reason, the last time the court adopted a major revision to Wisconsin's disciplinary rule, the Ethics 2000 process, which the adopted rules went into effect in July 1st, 2007, this rule was not included.
Why was that?
I have tried hard to find out.
Well, does it have anything to do with us being unable to define the practice of law?
I don't believe so, because this doesn't really have to do with defining the practice of law.
But it deals with provision of law-related services.
And the rule itself defines law-related services. So there is a reasonably clear definition. I've spoken to Director Celine, Professor Mike McChrystal, who is the reporter of the Ethics 2000 Commission, Professor Ralph Cagle, Mr. Dietrich, and nobody can seem to remember why.
And did you check the records in the clerk's office on this file?
I have contacted, I believe, Ms. Rich, she can correct me if I'm wrong, to see if something might be available. I've looked at the state bar to see what records we have available, and I haven't been able to discern a clear reason. The response I got from a couple participants in the Ethics 2000 process was there was some concern because at the time there was consideration about multidisciplinary practice being revived, which is a different animal than provision of law-related services. Multidisciplinary services would be a theory which is currently prohibited by the rules, wherein lawyers could partner, share joint ownership of a law firm with non-lawyers, for example, accountants, and provide a whole panoply of services under those auspices. Rule ABA Model Rule 5.7, which we're suggesting is 5.8, would not allow for that. It simply provides guidance to Wisconsin lawyers who do something as common as being a real estate lawyer who also sells title insurance. That, under the definition, is a provision of a law-related service. And our experience as people who advise lawyers on the Ethics Committee is ABA Model Rule 5.7 reflects the consensus of how everyone would advise someone providing law-related services. It's consistent with Wisconsin's older ethics opinions on this topic. And rather than simply repeating to lawyers, as we continually do, 5.7 is not adopted in Wisconsin, but we think it provides good guidance. It's consistent with these prior ethics opinions. We think it should simply be adopted in Wisconsin. Many other states have.
5.8 or 7?
It's ABA Model Rule 5.7, but because we already have the 5.7 slot occupied by limited liability practice, it would be 20:5.8.
Okay.
Under, or at least we're suggesting that.
So where
Wisconsin
is that described in your petition?
It's on page 44 of tab 1.
A44 of the appendix.
All right. And this is 5.7, is that right? And you're just putting in 5.8.
That is correct.
Okay. So you have the ABA comment. And do you have a Wisconsin comment?
No, we do not.
No, but you have on page A48, supporting information for the proposed amendment.
That's correct.
And we discussed when you were last here, you have supporting information for the proposed amendment in several places, but it would not appear in the final version.
We would suggest not. We drafted that information to explain our rationale for suggesting the proposed amendments to the rules and comments, but they were not drafted with an eye towards providing guidance as the comments would
well,
to lawyers.
Well, if it's good enough for the court, why isn't it good enough for the lawyers?
That might be a question I'm not prepared to answer.
Well, it's the basic for your comment.
Yeah, I would suggest the following. Most of it is explaining what the ABA Ethics 2020 Commission's rationale was for the proposed rule. And while it may be of interest to some lawyers, I don't think a large number would find it particularly useful in figuring out how do I comply with this disciplinary rule. And simply for the interest of brevity, we feel that
well,
the comments
I'll tell you, it
provide
came,
sufficient
it came up and I looked at it again for a reason I'll quickly tell you.
Sure.
In Rule 20:1.1, competence, where you added ABA comments relating to contracting with other lawyers, outsourcing.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't think this is an important section. This is your proposed amendment, too. It's important because it relates to lawyer competence, and loyalty and competence would seem to be the two most important things about legal representation.
I would agree, and confidentiality.
Lawyer's competence. Okay, I'll give you confidentiality.
Thank you.
All right. And this is outsourcing. And your comment, and we talked about it the last time, explains that this is relatively new and refers to increased and ongoing outsourcing, which might not have been so prevalent 5 years ago or 3 years ago. And it talks about the addition of new paragraph 6 provides guidance by identifying factors considering, et cetera. And it seems to me that it is informative to lawyers. And I wanted to talk to you about this because we recently had, and this is in an open order of this court, in which we told prosecutors who you say don't have a client.
I would not take that position. My personal belief is that prosecutors do in fact have a client. However, that's an open question. The client of a government lawyer is something intentionally not defined by the rules of professional conduct. It's defined by other law. So it's open for the argument that prosecutors do not have a client.
Now, I assume that this whole provision about outsourcing is designed to say to the lawyer, you may outsource, right?
Provided, that's correct.
And it's ethical to outsource, right?
Provided certain precautions are observed.
Okay, what are the precautions?
Well, they are set forth in ABA comment paragraph 6.
Right,
which is
and
one
so
of the
you're looking at the education, experience, and reputation of the non-firm lawyers, the nature of the services assigned to the non-firm lawyers, legal protections, professional conduct rules, and ethical environment of the jurisdictions in which the services will be performed, right?
That's
so
correct.
If they abide by all of that, they can hire retained lawyers, right?
That is correct.
Then in 7, you say when lawyers from more than one law firm are providing legal services, the lawyers, that's both the inside and outside lawyers, as I read it, ordinarily should consult with each other and the client about the scope of representation and allocation of responsibility. And then it says when making allocations in a matter pending before a tribunal, lawyers and parties may have additional obligations that are a matter of law beyond the scope of these rules. For instance,
the responsibility of the sponsoring lawyer in a pro hoc vice admission.
Okay.
Right. For example, if I'm an Illinois lawyer and I want to be admitted pro hoc vice in Wisconsin, I need a Wisconsin lawyer
right.
who actually participates in the matter to sponsor my admission. And the rules of professional conduct do not define the responsibility of the sponsoring lawyer. We have some case law, and we have Rule 10.03 in the Wisconsin rules. Similarly, we have a recently enacted 802.045 of the Wisconsin statutes allowing for a limited appearance in a matter. So as of January 1st, 2015, in Wisconsin, a lawyer appearing before a tribunal can follow a prescribed procedure and use a court form to enter a limited appearance before a tribunal.
Is that limited scope representation?
That is limited scope representation.
Okay.
So the statute, in part, defines some of the responsibilities of the lawyer making a limited appearance in the matter.
Do you see that a court would tell a lawyer, no, you can't retain other outside counsel?
Well, I would say the following. We do have Wisconsin case law that in which courts have revoked pro hoc vice admissions on a matter.
And there's a conflict of interest.
Or bad behavior of the out-of-state lawyer that was admitted. It is presumptively within the discretion of the court to deny a pro hoc vice.
The sitting court says so long.
That's correct.
Right.
Mm-hmm. So
for some goof that's been at.
Generally, courts have wide discretion with respect to allowing appearances of lawyers and granting permission to withdraw in a matter. So I can certainly envision, I don't think it's frequent, but I can envision situations in which a sitting trial court judge might deny an appearance to a lawyer.
Mm-hmm. For a rational reason.
Mm-hmm. Presumptively. It's within what the law would allow for.
So it would be the jurisdiction, the court in which the lawyer appeared, that would say,
that's correct.
You can't come
yeah.
here.
when I'm making an appearance in front of a court, I have to follow local court rules, whatever they might be. If there's statutory obligations that, as you know, 802.045 might affect how I make my appearance in the matter, I have to follow those. I have to abide by my obligations under the rule. What I think that sentence just reflects is, lawyers, you should be aware that there might be other obligations imposed by statute or local court rule or some other source of law.
You might want to look at that John Doe order and see if there should be reference made.
Are there any other sections that were not included?
No. Just in my discussions with Ms. Rich, I believe I touched upon it at the last hearing,
right.
The proposed amendment to model or Rule 5.5 sub D was part of the Ethics 2020 process, but because we felt it was important to reference it in relation to the suggested one-word change in 5.7A1, that was also included today. So that would be the only additional information I would have.
Okay.
One of the points I brought up when we first heard 1503 was that this committee had only lawyers, no non-lawyers.
That's correct.
And we heard from, I think it was Ms. Fowler, who'd been on a number of, who is not a lawyer, a public member, and had been on a variety of boards with the OLR. And she may very well now be on a district committee. And no, nothing was ever heard from about anyone other than lawyers. And Mr. Diedrich, whom I've had great confidence in and who does a terrific job for the bar and for himself and for us, said, well, you didn't need non-lawyers. This is just lawyer business. What's your view on that?
Well, I would say the following, that we propose these amendments pursuant to our defined responsibilities under the state bar bylaws, one of those being to suggest changes to the rules of professional conduct. And the composition of the State Bar Standing Committee on Professional Ethics is, again, governed by State Bar bylaws, and consequently, we're all lawyers on the State Bar's committee. We certainly have no objection to non-lawyer participation in rules amendment process, but being who we are, the committee made up of members of the bar, simply at any point in the process, we just did not consider that, well, we should bring in some non-lawyers to look at these rules. Perhaps that was an error on our part, but it just
didn't occur
to us.
What do you think the obligation of the court is?
I think the obligation of the court is to adopt rules that they believe are consistent with their obligation to govern the practice of law in Wisconsin and to act in the public interest. And if that would include non-lawyer participation, we certainly have no objection to it.
Well, one of the things that I find missing here, and I think this is a very good job and got a lot of material, but I don't know what the pros and cons are for each of them. And there's no, everything is just sweetness and light. I don't see anybody saying, well, the problem with this is that. And yet, all of these went through an elaborate process at the ABA.
and minutes were kept, and documentation was kept, and they were not all unanimous as far as I could tell. And yet that's been cleansed here.
Well, I would say the following. To a large extent, while we monitored the process, we paid attention to the end product. So when the rules were adopted in the House of Delegates, and my recollection was I wasn't present at the August 2012 meeting, but there wasn't much contention.
Well,
at
that's
that point.
Before the House. Everything's been cleaned up by then because it's gone through all the sections and divisions and committees, and to the extent any of them had an objection that could be fairly readily handled, it was done. So by the time it got to the House, all the opposition, or most of it, is dissipated and it will be adopted. That's the whole point of how the ABA works. But so what you looked at was a final version of in which value judgments were made. And I question whether you all looked at these value judgments and then decided which ones you adopt. And clearly, we don't have them.
Well, I would say the following, that we did reach out once we had the final product to various groups within the bar. We had two presentations of the Board of Governors. I spent several hours on two different occasions with Mr. Saleen. It's my understanding he presented it to the Board of Administrative Oversight. They had no problem. We didn't hear much in the cons category. I can't really remember much objection to any of the proposed changes.
Yeah, what has been presented is a majority view that's been cleaned up in the ABA and which you then look at and adopt or not adopt. I recognize you didn't adopt everything per se.
And I would say the following, that there were other amendments to the model rules that were adopted in February 2013 that, after consideration, we decided would not be appropriate to recommend.
Well, as a matter of fact, the most, controversial sections are not here.
Regarding foreign...
Multi-jurisdictional... law firms being owned by non-lawyers. I mean, the really cutting-edge issues are not here.
That is correct.
What is here are, it's important to do this, is clean up on some issues. And most of it's commentary, not text.
We did not view this as as a large substantive revision of the rules. The way we looked at it was primarily it's to provide clarification and guidance, meaning it explained the duties embodied in the black letter of the rule better than previous comments did. The expansion in the comments recognized new case law or new ethics opinions. So the large substantive issues of should lawyers be allowed to partner with non-lawyers to provide a vast array of services? Should you be allowed to share legal fees with non-lawyers? Should law firms be allowed to issue public stock? Are certainly worthy of consideration. The Ethics 2020 Commission briefly considered whether they should expand their brief to take on those larger questions. They decided not to. So there's nothing that the ABA proposed or adopted that would have allowed for multidisciplinary practice or non-lawyer ownership of law firms. I'm not suggesting those are not worthy of considerations, but those are big, complicated questions. And I would suggest that those questions would clearly need to be considered and debated beyond our cozy little committee that was looking at, in some respects, technical amendments to the rules. Not all, but to a large extent, we viewed them as such.
I would put this all at low-hanging fruit.
To a large extent, I would say yes.
That's what I think.
Reasonably non-controversial and to a large extent explanatory.
And it doesn't cover a number of issues that the court has had difficulty with and has outlined in its various opinions on OLR matters.
Well, we were dealing with the substantive disciplinary rules.
And I'm talking about the substantive disciplinary rules. I'm not talking about the practice and procedures of OLR. But there have been any number that have been discussed.
Yeah. You know, in response, I would say part of it is we had things drafted, and there are always new cases and new issues that arise. So it was simply a matter of timing, getting our finished product approved by the Board of Governors, filed with the court.
Thank you very much. Any other questions? Well, that closes the hearing on 1503.
Did that gentleman want to talk?
I asked at the beginning. Oh, I am very sorry. I am so sorry. Thank you, Justice Abramson. You even told me, and I skipped over you to begin with. I'm in a skipping mood today for some reason or other. Please come forward. Thank
you
very, very much.
It's okay. My comments are going to be incredibly brief, 1 minute or less, I promise.
Okay.
My name is Attorney Will McKinley. I practice with the Minn Law Firm up in Appleton, and I am the vice chair of the State Bar Ethics Committee.
Okay.
I'm here today because my illustrious colleague, Mr. Dietrich, could not be here. I told him I would make sure to draw to your attention that he did submit comments in writing,
right,
and I will not regurgitate those here today.
Yeah.
My only other purpose for speaking is I just want to thank you all very much for your time and reviewing our, what I can only describe as an omnibus petition for rule changes. We understand this is very tedious, oftentimes as exciting as watching paint dry, but it is important, especially from the practitioner's point of view. I'm an M&A guy, so I'm a little bit of a fish out of water even standing here. But these rule changes will certainly help just make our lives in the trenches that much easier to try to help figure things out. So just thank you again very much for your time.
Okay. Well, and thank you, and sorry to keep stepping over the top of you here. Well, thank you for the organization of 1503, and thank you very much, Attorney Pierce, for focusing us first on the broad picture, and then today, just right down the line. I think it was very helpful, at least personally to me, it was helpful to be able to decipher, as well as your written materials. I like the way you put them together. I like the appendix. I like the back and forth. To me, it all worked very well. I know it was a huge amount of work, and thank you very much. I see we have other members of the State Bar who I know worked on putting this together. So thank you very much. It's very well done. Did you have something you wanted to say, Justice Prosser?
Well, I finished the morning session with a comment.
Okay, well,
so,
you go right ahead.
I know the Minn Law Firm from my hometown is an absolutely outstanding law firm. And to see Mr. McKinley here all day long waiting for his 1 minute spot.
I know, and I keep trying to skip him. My goodness.
He could probably put kids through college for the amount of fees that he's lost today. So we thank you.
Yeah.
No,
thank you.
Seriously, I think you've really done yourself great good here, coming and staying through this whole process, and thank you very much.
Yeah. Okay, well, we are adjourned now. We are going to meet at the table at 20 minutes to 4. To see if we can do one or two things yet this afternoon in open conference. So I will see all my colleagues at the table in 10 minutes.